The amount of material I have to sift through is immense, for all of the cities have stood for hundreds of years, and some antedate the arrival of humans in Alagasia. Is it likely you will actually find anything? No, not likely. It is never likely that you will succeed in ferreting out the secrets of the past, but I may still prevail, given enough time. I have no doubt that what I am searching for exists in each of the cities. They are too old not to contain surreptitious ways in and out through their walls. However, it is another question entirely whether records of those ways exist, and whether we possess those records. People who know about concealed trapdoors and the like usually want to keep the information to themselves. Jode grasped a handful of the papers next to him on the cot, and brought them closer to his face, then snorted and tossed the papers away. I'm trying to solve riddles invented by people who didn't want them to be solved. He and Aragon continued talking about other, less important matters, until Helen reappeared, carrying three mugs of steaming hot red clover tea. As Aragon accepted his mug, he noted that her earlier anger seemed to have subsided, and he wondered if she had been listening outside to what Jode had said about her. She handed Jode his mug, and from somewhere behind Aragon, procured a tin plate laden with flat biscuits and a small clay pot of honey. Then she withdrew a few feet, and stood leaning against the center pole, blowing on her own mug. As was polite, Jode waited until Aragon had taken a biscuit from the plate and consumed a bite of it before saying, "To what do I owe the pleasure of your company, Aragon? Unless I am mistaken, this is no idle visit." Aragon sipped his tea. "After the Battle of the Burning Plains, I promised I would tell you how Brom died. That is why I have come." A grey pallor replaced the colour in Jode's cheeks. "Oh, I don't have to, if that's not what you want," Aragon quickly pointed out. With an effort, Jode shook his head. "No, I do. You merely caught me by surprise." When Jode did not ask Helen to leave, Aragon was uncertain whether he should continue. But then he decided that it did not matter if Helen or anyone else heard his story. In a slow, deliberate voice, Aragon began to recount the events that had transpired since he and Brom had left Jode's house. He described their encounter with the band of Urgles, their search for the Razak and Drasleona, how the Razak had ambushed them outside the city, and how the Razak had stabbed Brom as they fled from Murtag's attack. Aragon's throat constricted as he spoke of Brom's last hours, of the cool sandstone cave where he had lain, of the feelings of helplessness that had assailed Aragon as he watched Brom slipping away, of the smell of death that had pervaded the dry air, of Brom's final words, of the sandstone tomb Aragon had made with magic, and of how Saphira had transformed it into pure diamond. "If only I had known what I know now," Aragon said, "then I could have saved him. Instead," unable to summon words past the tightness in his throat, he wiped his eyes and gulped at his tea. He wished it was something stronger. A sigh escaped Jode. "And so ended Brom. Alas, we are all far worse off without him. If he could have chosen the means of his death, though, I think he would have chosen to die like this in the service of the Varden, defending the last free dragon rider." "Were you aware that he had been a rider himself?" Jode nodded. "The Varden told me before I met him. He seemed as if he was a man who revealed little about himself," observed Helen. Jode and Aragon laughed. "That he was," said Jode. "I still have not recovered from the shock of seeing him and you, Aragon, standing on our doorstep. Brom always kept his own counsel, but we became close friends when we were travelling together, and I cannot understand why he let me believe he was dead for what, 16, 17 years? Too long. What's more, since it was Brom who delivered Sephira's egg to the Vardhan after he slew Morzan in Gilead, the Vardhan couldn't very well tell me they had her egg without revealing that Brom was still alive. So I've spent the better part of 2 decades convinced that the one great adventure of my life had ended in failure, and that as a result we had lost our only hope of having a dragon rider to help us overthrow Galbatorix. The knowledge was no easy burden, I can assure you. With one hand, Jode rubbed his brow. When I opened our front door and realized whom I was looking at, I thought that the ghosts of my past had come to haunt me. Brom said he kept himself hidden to ensure that he would still be alive to train the new rider when he or she should appear. But his explanation has never entirely satisfied me. Why was it necessary for him to cut himself off from nearly everyone he knew or cared about? What was he afraid of? What was he protecting? Jode fingered the handle of his mug. I cannot prove it, but it seems to me that Brom must have discovered something in Gilead when he was fighting Morzan and his dragon. Something so momentous it moved Brom to abandon everything that was his life up until then. It's a fanciful conjecture, I admit, but I cannot account for Brom's actions, except by postulating that there was a piece of information he never shared with me, nor another living soul. Again Jode sighed, and he drew a hand down his long face. After so many years apart, I had hoped Brom and I might ride together once more. But fate had other ideas, it seems. And then to lose him a second time, but a few weeks after discovering he was still alive, was a cruel joke for the world to play. Helen swept past Aragorn and went to stand by Jode, touching him on the shoulder. He offered her a wan smile and wrapped an arm around her narrow waist. I'm glad that you and Sephira gave Brom a tomb even a dwarf king might envy. He deserved that and more for all he did for Alagaesia. Although once people discover his grave, I have a horrible suspicion they will not hesitate to break it apart for the diamond. If they do, they will regret it, muttered Aragorn. He resolved to return to the site at the earliest opportunity and place wards around Brom's tomb to protect it from grave robbers. Besides, they will be too busy hunting gold lilies to bother Brom.
What?
Nothing. It's not important. The three of them sipped their tea. Helen nibbled on a biscuit. Then Aragorn asked,
You met Morzan, didn't you?
They were not the friendliest of occasions, but yes, I met him.
What was he like?
As a person? I really couldn't say. Although I'm well acquainted with tales of his atrocities. Every time Brom and I crossed paths with him, he was trying to kill us. Or rather, capture, torture, and then kill us. None of which are conducive to establishing a close relationship.
Aragorn was too intent to respond to Jode's humour. Jode shifted on the bed.
As a warrior, Morzan was terrifying. We spent a great deal of time running away from him, I seem to remember. Him and his dragon, that is. Few things are as frightening as having an enraged dragon chasing you.
How did he look?
You seem inordinately interested in him.
Aragorn blinked once.
I'm curious. He was the last of the Forsworn to die, and Brom was the one who slew him. And now Morzan's son is my mortal enemy.
Let me see, then, said Jode. He was tall. He had broad shoulders. His hair was dark, like a raven's feathers. And his eyes were different colours. One was blue and one was black. His chin was bare, and he was missing the tip of one of his fingers, I forget which. Handsome he was, in a cruel, haughty manner, and when he spoke, he was most charismatic. His armour was always polished bright, whether mail or a breastplate, as if he had no fear of being spotted by his enemies, which I suppose he hadn't. When he laughed, it sounded as if he were in pain.
What of his companion? The woman, Selina, did you meet her as well?
Joad laughed.
If I had, I would not be here today. Morzan may have been a fearsome swordsman, a formidable magician, and a murderous traitor. But it was that woman of his who inspired the most terror in people. Morzan only used her for missions that were so repugnant, difficult, or secretive that no one else would agree to undertake them. She was his black hand, and her presence always signalled imminent death, torture, betrayal, or some other horror.
Aragorn felt sick hearing his mother described thusly.
She was utterly ruthless, devoid of either pity or compassion. It was said that when she asked Morzan to enter his service, he tested her by teaching her the word for heal in the ancient language, for she was a spellcaster as well as a common fighter, and then pitting her against 12 of his finest swordsmen.
How did she defeat them?
She healed them of their fear and their hate, and all the things that drive a man to kill. And then, while they stood, grinning at each other like idiot sheep, she went up to the men and cut their throats. Are you feeling well, Aragorn? You are as pale as a corpse.
I'm fine. What else do you remember?
Joad tapped the side of his mug.
Precious little concerning Selina.
She was always somewhat of an enigma.
No one besides Morzan even knew her real name until just a few months before Morzan's death. To the public at large, she has never been anything other than the Black Hand.
The Black Hand we have now, the collection of spies, assassins, and magicians who carry out Galbatorix's low skullduggery, is Galbatorix's attempt to recreate Selina's usefulness to Morzan. Even among the Varden, only a handful of people were privy to her name, and most of them are mouldering in graves now.
As I recall, it was Brom who discovered her true identity.
Before I went to the Varden with the information concerning the secret passageway into Castle Illyria, which the elves built millennia ago and which Galbatorix expanded upon to form the Black Citadel that now dominates Urubane, before I went to them, Brom had spent a rather significant length of time spying on Morzan's estate, in the hope he might unearth a hitherto unsuspected weakness of Morzan's. I believe Brom gained admittance to Morzan's hall by disguising himself as a member of the serving staff. It was then that he found out what he did about Selina. Still, we never did learn why she was so attached to Morzan. Perhaps she loved him. In any event, she was utterly loyal to him, even to the point of death. Soon after Brom killed Morzan, word reached the Varden that sickness had taken her. It is as if the trained hawk was so fond of her master she could not live without him.
She was not entirely loyal, thought Aragorn.
She defied Morzan when it came to me, even though she lost her life as a result.
If only she could have rescued Murtagh as well.
As for Joad's accounts of her misdeeds, Aragorn chose to believe that Morzan had perverted her essentially good nature. For the sake of his own sanity, Aragorn could not accept that both his parents had been evil.
She loved him, he said,
staring at the murky dregs at the bottom of his mug.
In the beginning, she loved him. Maybe not so much later. Murtagh is her son.
Joad raised an eyebrow.
Indeed. You have it from Murtagh himself, I suppose?
Aragorn nodded.
Well, that explains a number of questions I always had. Murtagh's mother. I'm surprised that Brom didn't uncover that particular secret. Morzan did everything he could to conceal Murtagh's existence, even from the other members of the Forsworn. Knowing the history of those power-hungry, backstabbing knaves, he probably saved Murtagh's life. More's the pity, too.
Silence crept among them then, like a shy animal ready to flee at the slightest motion. Aragorn continued to gaze into his mug.
A host of questions bedeviled him, but he knew that Joad could not answer them,
and it was unlikely anyone else could either. Why had Brom hidden himself in Carvajal? To keep watch over Aragorn, the son of his most hated foe? Had it been some cruel joke, giving Aragorn Zarok his father's blade, and why had Brom not told him the truth about his parentage? He tightened his grip on the mug and, without meaning to, shattered the clay. The three of them started at the unexpected noise.
"Here, let me help you with that,"
said Helen, bustling forward and dabbing at his tunic with a rag. Embarrassed, Aragorn apologized several times, to which both Jode and Helen responded by assuring him it was a small mishap and not to worry himself about it. While Helen picked up the shards of fire-hardened clay, Jode began to dig through the layers of books, scrolls and loose papers that covered the bed, saying,
"Ah, it had nearly slipped my mind. I have something for you, Aragorn, that might prove useful. If only I can find it here."
With a pleased exclamation, he straightened, flourishing a book which he handed to Aragorn. It was Domia Aberwyrda, The Dominance of Fate, a complete history of Alagaesia written by Heslant the Monk. Aragorn had first seen it in Jode's library in Tirm. He had not expected that he would ever get a chance to examine it again. Savoring the feeling, he ran his hands over the carved leather on the front cover, which was shiny with age, then opened the book, and admired the neat rows of runes within, lettered in glossy red ink. Awed by the size of the knowledge hoard he held, Aragorn said, "You wish me to have this?"
"I do," asserted Jode.
He moved out of the way as Helen retrieved a fragment of the mug from under the bed.
"I think you might profit by it. You are engaged in historic events, Aragorn, and the roots of the difficulties you face lie in happenings from decades, centuries, and millennia ago. If I were you, I would study at every opportunity the lessons history has to teach us, for they may help you with the problems of today. In my own life, reading the record of the past has often provided me with the courage and the insight to choose the correct path."
Aragorn longed to accept the gift, but still he hesitated.
"Brom said that Domia Aberwyrda was the most valuable thing in your house, and rare as well. Besides, what of your work? Don't you need this for your research?"
"Domia Aberwyrda is valuable, and it is rare," said Jode, "but only in the Empire, where Galbatorix burns every copy he finds and hangs their unfortunate owners. Here in the camp I have already had 6 copies foisted upon me by members of King Orin's court, and this is hardly what one would call a great centre of learning. However, I do not part with it lightly, and only because you can put it to better use than I can. Books should go where they will be most appreciated, and not sit unread, gathering dust on a forgotten shelf. Don't you agree?"
"I do."
Aragorn closed Domia Aberwyrda, and again traced the intricate patterns on the front with his fingers, fascinated by the swirling designs that had been chiseled into the leather.
"Thank you. I shall treasure it for as long as it is mine to watch over."
Jode dipped his head and leaned back against the wall of the tent, appearing satisfied. Turning the book on its edge, Aragorn examined the lettering on the spine.
"What was Heslant a monk of?"
"A small, secretive sect called the Arcana, that originated in the area by Kuasta. Their order, which has endured for at least 500 years, believes that all knowledge is sacred."
The end of a smile lent Jode's features a mysterious cast.
"They have dedicated themselves to collecting every piece of information in the world and preserving it against a time when they believe an unspecified catastrophe will destroy all the civilizations in Alagaesia."
"It seems a strange religion," Aragorn said.
"Are not all religions strange to those who stand outside of them?"
countered Jode. Aragorn said,
"I have a gift for you as well, or rather, for you, Helen."
She tilted her head, a quizzical frown on her face.
"Your family was a merchant family, yes?"
She jerked her chin in an affirmative.
Were you very familiar with the business yourself?
Lightning sparked in Helen's eyes.
If I had not married him,
she motioned with a shoulder,
I would have taken over the family affairs when my father died. I was an only child, and my father taught me everything he knew.
That was what Aragorn had hoped to hear. To Jod, he said,
You claimed that you are content with your lot here with the Varden.
And so I am, mostly.
I understand. However, you risked a great deal to help Brom and me, and you risked even more to help Roran and everyone else from Carvajal.
The Palancar Pirates.
Aragorn chuckled and continued, Without your assistance, the Empire would surely have captured them.
And because of your act of rebellion, you both lost all that was dear to you in Tirm.
We would have lost it anyway. I was bankrupt, and the twins had betrayed me to the Empire. It was only a matter of time before Lord Ristart had me arrested.
Maybe, but you still helped Roran. Who can blame you if you were protecting your own necks at the same time? The fact remains that you abandoned your lives in Tirm in order to steal the Dragonwing along with Roran and the villagers. And for your sacrifice, I will always be grateful. So this is part of my thanks.
Sliding a finger underneath his belt, Aragorn removed the second of the three gold orbs and presented it to Helen. She cradled it as gently as if it were a baby robin. While she gazed at it with wonder, and Jod craned his neck to see over the edge of her hand, Aragorn said,
It's not a fortune, but if you are clever you should be able to make it grow. What Nasawada did with lace taught me that there is a great deal of opportunity for a person to prosper in war.
Oh, yes, breathed Helen. War is a merchant's delight.
For one, Nasawada mentioned to me last night at dinner that the dwarves are running low on mead. And as you might suspect, they have the means to buy as many casks as they want, even if the price were a thousandfold of what it was before the war. But then that's just a suggestion. You may find others who are more desperate to trade if you look for yourself.
Aragorn staggered back a step as Helen rushed at him and embraced him. Her hair tickled his chin. She released him, suddenly shy. Then her excitement burst forth again, and she lifted the honey-coloured globe in front of her nose and said,
Thank you, Aragorn. Oh, thank you.
She pointed at the gold.
This I can use. I know I can. With it I'll build an empire even larger than my father's.
The shiny orb disappeared within her clenched fist.
You believe my ambition exceeds my abilities? It shall be as I have said. I shall not fail.
Aragorn bowed to her.
I hope that you succeed, and that your success benefits us all.
Aragorn noticed that hard cords stood out in Helen's neck as she curtsied and said,
You are most generous, Shadeslayer. Again, I thank you.
Yes, thank you,
said Jod, rising from the bed.
I cannot think that we deserve this.
Helen shot him a furious look, which he ignored.
But it is most welcome, nevertheless.
Improvising, Aragorn added, And for you, Jod, your gift is not from me, but Saphira. She has agreed to let you fly on her when you both have a spare hour or two. It pained Aragorn to share Saphira, and he knew that she would be upset he had not consulted her before volunteering her services. But after giving Helen the gold, he would have felt guilty about not giving Jod something of equal value. A film of tears glazed Jod's eyes. He grasped Aragorn's hand and shook it, and still holding it, said,
I cannot imagine a higher honour. Thank you. You don't know how much you have done for us.
Extricating himself from Jod's grip, Aragorn edged toward the entrance to the tent, while excusing himself as gracefully as he could, and making his farewells. Finally, after yet another round of thanks on their part, and a self-deprecating, it was nothing, he managed to escape outdoors. Aragorn hefted Domir Aberweirde, and then glanced at the sun. It would not be long until Saphira returned, but he still had time to attend to one other thing. First, though, he would have to stop by his tent. He did not want to risk damaging Domir Aberweirde by carrying it with him across the camp.
"I own a book," he thought, delighted.
He set off at a trot, clasping the book against his chest, as Blodgarm and the other elves followed close behind. I Need a Sword. Once Domir Aberweirde was safely ensconced in his tent, Aragorn went to the Varden's armory, a large open pavilion filled with racks of spears, swords, pikes, bows and crossbows. Mounds of shields and leather armor filled slatted crates. The more expensive mail, tunics, coifs and leggings hung on wooden stands. Hundreds of conical helmets gleamed like polished silver. Bales of arrows lined the pavilion, and among them sat a score or more fletchers, busy refurbishing arrows whose feathers had been damaged during the Battle of the Burning Plains. A constant stream of men rushed in and out of the pavilion, some bringing weapons and armor to be repaired, others new recruits coming to be outfitted, and still others ferrying equipment to different parts of the camp. Everyone seemed to be shouting at the top of their lungs. And in the center of the commotion stood the man Aragorn had hoped to see, Frederick, the Varden's weapon master. Blodgarm accompanied Aragorn as he strode into the pavilion toward Frederick. As soon as they stepped underneath the cloth roof, the men inside fell silent, their eyes fixed on the two of them. Then they resumed their activities, albeit with quicker steps and quieter voices. Raising an arm in welcome, Frederick hurried to meet them. As always, he wore his suit of hairy, oxide armor, which smelled nearly as offensive as the animal must have in its original form, as well as a massive two-handed sword hung crosswise over his back, the hilt projecting above his right shoulder.
"Shadeslayer," he rumbled, "how can I help you this fine afternoon?"
"I need a sword."
Frederick's smile broke through his beard.
"Ah, I wondered if you'd be visiting me about that. When you set out for Hellgrind without a blade in hand, I thought, well, maybe you're beyond such things now. Maybe you can do all your fighting with magic."
"No, not yet."
"Well, I can't say as I'm sorry. Everyone needs a good sword, no matter how skilled they may be with conjuring. In the end, it always comes down to steel against steel. Just you watch, that's how this fight with the Empire will be resolved, with the point of a sword being driven through Galbatorix's accursed heart. Huh, I'd wager a year's wages that even Galbatorix has a sword of his own, and that he uses it too, despite him being able to gut you like a fish with a flick of his finger. Nothing can quite compare to the feel of fine steel in your fist."
While he spoke, Frederick led them toward a rack of swords that stood apart from the others.
"What kind of sword are you looking for?" he asked. "That Zarok you had was a one-handed sword, if I remember rightly, with a blade about two thumbs wide, two of my thumbs in any case, and of a shape equally suited for both the cut and thrust, yes?"
Aragorn indicated that was so, and the weapon master grunted, and began to pull swords off the rack and swing them through the air, only to replace them with seeming dissatisfaction.
"Elf blades tend to be thinner and lighter than ours or the dwarves, on account of the enchantments they forge into the steel. If we made ours as delicate as theirs, the swords wouldn't last more than a minute in a battle, before bending, breaking, or chipping so badly you couldn't cut soft cheese with them."
His eyes darted toward Blodgarm.
"Isn't that so, Elf?"
"Even as you say, human,"
responded Blodgarm in a perfectly modulated voice. Frederick nodded and examined the edge of another sword, then snorted and dropped it back on the rack.
"Which means whatever sword you choose will probably be heavier than you're used to. That shouldn't pose much difficulty for you, Shadeslayer. But the extra weight may still upset the timing of your blows.
I appreciate the warning, said Aragorn.
Not at all, said Frederick. That's what I'm here for. To keep as many of the Varden from getting killed as I can, and to help them kill as many of Galbatorix's blasted soldiers as I can. It's a good job.
Leaving the rack, he lumbered over to another one, hidden behind a pile of rectangular shields.
Finding the right sword for someone is an art unto itself. A sword should feel like an extension of your arm, as if it had grown out of your very flesh. You shouldn't have to think about how you want it to move. You should simply move it as instinctively as an egret his beak or a dragon her claws. The perfect sword is intent incarnate. What you want, so it does.
You sound like a poet.
With a modest expression, Frederick half shrugged.
I've been picking weapons for men who were about to march into combat for 26 years. It seeps into your bones after a while, turns your mind to thoughts of fate and destiny, and whether that young fellow I sent off with a built pike would still be alive if I had given him a mace instead.
Frederick paused with a hand hovering over the middle sword on the rack and looked at Aragorn.
Do you prefer to fight with or without a shield?
With, Aragorn said. But I can't carry one around with me all the time. And there never seems to be one handy when I'm attacked.
Frederick tapped the hilt of the sword and gnawed on the edge of his beard.
So you need a sword you can use by itself, but that's not too long to use with every kind of shield from a buckler to a wall shield. That means a sword of medium length, easy to wield with one arm. It has to be a blade you can wear at all occasions, elegant enough for a coronation, and tough enough to fend off a band of Khal. He grimaced. It's not natural what Nasuard has done. Allying us with those monsters, it can't last. The likes of us and them were never meant to mix.
He shook himself.
It's a pity you only want a single sword.
Or am I mistaken?
No. Sephira and I travelled far too much to be lugging around a half dozen blades.
I suppose you're right. Besides, a warrior like you isn't expected to have more than one weapon. The curse of the named blade, I call it.
What's that?
Every great warrior, said Frederick, wields a sword, it's usually a sword, that has a name. Either he names it himself, or once he proves his prowess with some extraordinary feat, the bards name it for him. Thereafter he has to use that sword. It's expected of him. If he shows up to a battle without it, his fellow warriors will ask where it is, and they will wonder if he is ashamed of his success, and if he is insulting them by rejecting the acclaim they have bestowed upon him. And even his enemies may insist upon waiting to fight until he fetches his famed blade. Just you watch. As soon as you fight Murtagh or do anything else memorable with your new sword, the Varden will insist upon giving it a title. And they will look to see it on your hip from then on.
He continued speaking while he proceeded to a third rack.
I never thought I would be fortunate enough to help a rider choose his weapon. What an opportunity! It feels as if this is a culmination of my work with the Varden.
Plucking a sword from the rack, Frederick handed it to Aragorn. Aragorn tilted the tip of the sword up and down, then shook his head. The shape of the hilt was wrong for his hand. The weapon master did not seem disappointed. To the contrary, Aragorn's rejection seemed to invigorate him, as if he relished the challenge Aragorn posed. He presented another sword to Aragorn, and again Aragorn shook his head. The balance was too far forward for his liking.
What worries me, Frederick said, returning to the rack, is that any sword I give you will have to withstand impacts that would destroy an ordinary blade. What you need is dwarf work. Their smiths are the finest, besides the elves, and sometimes they even exceed them.
Frederick peered at Aragon.
Hold now. I've been asking the wrong questions. How was it you were taught to block and parry? Was it edge on edge?
I seem to recall you doing something of the kind when you duelled Arya in Farthendur.
Aragon frowned.
What of it?
What of it?
Frederick guffawed.
Not to be disrespectful, Shadeslayer, but if you hit the edge of a sword against that of another, you will cause grave damage to both. That might not have been a problem with an enchanted blade like Zarok, but you can't do it with any of the swords I have here, not unless you want to replace your sword after every battle.
An image flashed in Aragorn's mind of the chipped edges of Murtagh's sword, and he felt irritated with himself for having forgotten something so obvious. He had become accustomed to Zarok, which never dulled, never showed signs of wear, and so far as he knew was impervious to most spells. He was not even sure it was possible to destroy a rider's sword.
You need not worry about that. I will protect the sword with magic. Must I wait all day for a weapon?
One more question, Shadeslayer. Will your magic last forever?
Aragorn's frown deepened.
Since you ask, no. Only one elf understands the making of a rider's sword, and she has not shared her secrets with me. What I can do is transfer a certain amount of energy into a sword. The energy will keep it from getting damaged until the blows that would have damaged the sword exhaust the store of energy, at which point the sword will revert to its original state, and odds are, shatter in my grip the next time I close with my opponent.
Frederick scratched his beard.
I'll take your word for it, Shadeslayer. The point being, if you hammer on soldiers long enough, you'll wear out your spells. And the harder you hammer, the sooner the spells will vanish, eh?
Exactly.
Then you should still avoid going edge on edge, as it will wear out your spells faster than most any other move.
I don't have time for this,
Aragorn snapped, his impatience overflowing.
I don't have the time to learn a completely different way of fighting. The Empire might attack at any moment. I have to concentrate on practicing what I do know, not trying to master a whole new set of forms.
Frederick clapped his hands.
I know just the thing for you, then.
Going to a crate filled with arms, he began digging through it, talking to himself as he did.
First this, then that, and then we'll see where we stand.
From the bottom of the crate, he pulled out a large black mace with a flanged head. Frederick rapped a knuckle against the mace.
You can break swords with this, you can split mail and batter in helms, and you won't do it the slightest bit of harm, no matter what you hit.
It's a club, Aragorn protested. A metal club.
What of it? With your strength, you can swing it as if it were light as a reed. You'll be a terror on the battlefield with this, you will.
Aragorn shook his head.
No. Smashing things isn't how I prefer to fight. Besides, I would never have been able to kill Durza by stabbing him through the heart if I'd been carrying a mace instead of a sword.
Then I have only one more suggestion, unless you insist upon a traditional blade.
From another part of the pavilion, Frederick brought Aragorn a weapon he identified as a falchion. It was a sword, but not a type of sword Aragorn was accustomed to, although he had seen them among the Varden before. The falchion had a polished, disc-shaped pommel, bright as a silver coin. A short grip made of wood covered with black leather, a curved crossguard carved with a line of dwarf runes, and a single-edged blade that was as long as his outstretched arm, and had a thin fuller on either side, close to the spine. The falchion was straight until about 6 inches from the end, where the back of the blade flared upward in a small peak, before gently curving down to the needle-sharp tip. This widening of the blade reduced the likelihood that the point would bend or snap when driven through armour, and lent the end of the falchion a fang-like appearance. Unlike a double-edged sword, the falchion was made to be held with the blade and crossguard perpendicular to the ground. The most curious aspect of the falchion, though, was the bottom half-inch of the blade, including the edge, which was pearly grey and substantially darker than the mirror-smooth steel above. The boundary between the two areas was wavy, like a silk scarf rippling in the wind. Aragorn pointed at the grey band. "I've not seen that before. What is it?"
"The Thrikken's Dahl," said Frederick. "The dwarves invented it. They temper the edge and the spine separately. The edge they make hard, harder than we dare with the whole of our blades. The middle of the blade and the spine they anneal, so that the back of the falchion is softer than the edge, soft enough to bend and flex and survive the stress of battle without fracturing like a frost-ridden file."
"Do the dwarves treat all their blades thusly?"
Frederick shook his head. "Only their single-edged swords and the finest of their double-edged swords."
He hesitated, and uncertainty crept into his gaze.
"You understand why I chose this for you, Shadeslayer, yes?"
Aragorn understood. With the blade of the falchion at right angles to the ground, unless he deliberately tilted his wrist, any blows he caught on the sword would strike the flat of the blade, saving the edge for attacks of his own. Wielding the falchion would require only a small adjustment to his fighting style. Striding out of the pavilion, he assumed a ready position with the falchion. Swinging it over his head, he brought it down upon the head of an imaginary foe, then twisted and lunged, beat aside an invisible spear, sprang 6 yards to his left, and, in a brilliant but impractical move, spun the blade behind his back, passing it from one hand to the next as he did so. His breathing and heartbeat calm as ever, he returned to where Frederick and Blodgarm were waiting. The speed and balance of the falchion had impressed Aragorn. It was not the equal of Zarok, but it was still a superb sword.
"You chose well," he said.
Frederick detected the reticence in his bearing, however, for he said,
"And yet you are not entirely pleased, Shadeslayer?"
Aragorn twirled the falchion in a circle, then grimaced.
"I just wish it didn't look so much like a big skinny knife. I feel rather ridiculous with it."
"Oh, pay no heed if your enemies laugh. They'll not be able to once you lop off their heads."
Amused, Aragorn nodded. "I'll take it."
"One moment, then," said Frederick,
and disappeared into the pavilion, returning with a black leather scabbard decorated with silver scrollwork. He handed the scabbard to Aragorn and asked,
"Did you ever learn how to sharpen a sword, Shadeslayer? You wouldn't have had need with Zarok, would you?"
"No,"
Aragorn admitted,
"but I am a fair hand with a whetstone. I can hone a knife until it is so keen it will cut a thread draped over it. Besides, I can always true up the edge with magic if I have to."
Frederick groaned and slapped his thighs, knocking loose a dozen or so hairs from his oxhide leggings.
"Oh, no! A razor-thin edge is just what you don't want on a sword. The bevel has to be thick, thick and strong. A warrior has to be able to maintain his equipment properly, and that includes knowing how to sharpen his sword."
Frederick insisted, then, on procuring a new whetstone for Aragorn, and showing him exactly how to put a battle-ready edge on the falchion, while they sat in the dirt beside the pavilion. Once he was satisfied that Aragorn could grind an entirely new edge on the sword, he said,
"You can fight with rusty armor, you can fight with a dented helmet, but if you want to see the sun rise again, never fight with a dull sword. If you've just survived a battle and you're tired as a man who has climbed one of the Beor Mountains and your sword isn't sharp as it is now, it doesn't matter how you feel, you plunk yourself down the first chance you get and pull out your whetstone and strop. Just as you would see to your horse or to Sephira before you attend to your own needs, so too you should care for your sword before yourself. Because without it, you're no more than helpless prey for your enemies."
They had been sitting out in the late afternoon sun for over an hour by the time the weapon master finally finished his instructions. As he did, a cool shadow slid over them, and Saphira landed close by.
"You waited," said Aragorn. "You deliberately waited. You could have rescued me ages ago, but instead you left me here to listen to Frederick go on about waterstones, oilstones, and whether linseed oil is better than rendered fat for protecting metal from water."
"And is it?"
"Not really. It's just not as smelly."
"But that's irrelevant. Why did you leave me to this doom?"
One of her thick eyelids drooped in a lazy wink.
"Don't exaggerate. Doom? You and I have far worse dooms to look forward to if we are not properly prepared. What the man with the smelly clothes was saying seemed important for you to know."
"Well, perhaps it was," he conceded. She arched her neck and licked the claws on her right foreleg. After thanking Frederick and bidding him farewell, and agreeing upon a meeting place with Blodgarm, Aragorn fastened the falchion to the belt of Beloth the Wise and clambered onto Saphira's back. He whooped, and she roared as she raised her wings and surged up into the sky. Giddy, Aragorn clung to the spike in front of him and watched the people and tents below dwindle away into flat, miniature versions of themselves. From above, the camp was a grid of grey, triangular peaks, the eastern faces of which were deep in shadow, giving the whole region a checkered appearance. The fortifications that encircled the camp bristled like a hedgehog, the white tips of the distant poles bright in the slanted sunlight. King Orin's cavalry was a mass of milling dots in the northwestern quadrant of the camp. To the east was the Urgal's camp, low and dark on the rolling plain. They soared higher. The cold, pure air stung Aragorn's cheeks and burned in his lungs. He took only shallow breaths. Beside them floated a thick column of clouds, looking as solid as whipped cream. Saphira spiraled around it, her ragged shadow racing across the plume. A lone scrap of moisture struck Aragorn, blinding him for a few seconds and filling his nose and mouth with frigid droplets. He gasped and wiped his face. They rose above the clouds. A red eagle screeched at them as it flew past. Saphira's flapping became labored, and Aragorn began to feel light-headed. Stilling her wings, Saphira glided from one thermal to the next, maintaining her altitude, but ascending no farther. Aragorn looked down. They were so high, height had ceased to matter, and things on the ground no longer seemed real. The Varden's camp was an irregularly shaped playing board covered with tiny grey and black rectangles. The Jeet River was a silver rope fringed with green tassels. To the south, the sulphurous clouds rising from the burning plains formed a range of glowing orange mountains, home to shadowy monsters that flickered in and out of existence. Aragorn quickly averted his gaze. For perhaps half an hour, he and Saphira drifted with the wind, relaxing in the silent comfort of each other's company. An inaudible spell served to insulate Aragorn from the chill. At last, they were alone together, alone as they had been in Palancar Valley before the Empire had intruded upon their life. Saphira was the first to speak.
"We are the rulers of the sky.
Here, at the ceiling of the world."
Aragorn reached up, as if from where he sat he could brush the stars. Banking to the left, Saphira caught a gust of warmer air from below, then leveled off again.
"You will marry Roran and Katrina tomorrow."
"What a strange thought that is. Strange Roran should marry, and strange I should be the one to perform the ceremony."
"Roran married. Thinking about it makes me feel older. Even we, who were boys but a short while ago, cannot escape the inexorable progress of time. So the generations pass, and soon it will be our turn to send our children out into the land to do the work that needs to be done.
but not unless we can survive the next few months.
Aye, there is that. Sapphira wobbled as turbulence buffeted them. Then she looked back at him and asked,
Ready?
Go! Tilting forward, she pulled her wings close against her sides and plummeted toward the ground, faster than a speeding arrow. Aragorn laughed as the sensation of weightlessness overtook him. He tightened his legs around Sapphira to keep himself from drifting away from her, then, overtaken by a surge of recklessness, released his grip and held his hands over his head. The disk of land below spun like a wheel as Sapphira augured through the air. Slowing and then stopping her rotation, she rolled to the right until she was falling upside down. Sapphira! Cried Aragorn and pounded her shoulder. A ribbon of smoke streaming from her nostrils, she righted herself and again pointed herself at the fast approaching ground. Aragorn's ears popped, and he worked his jaw as the pressure increased. Less than 1,000 feet above the Varden's camp, and only a few seconds from crashing into the tents and excavating a large and bloody crater, Sapphira allowed the wind to catch her wings. The subsequent jolt threw Aragorn forward, and the spike he had been holding nearly stabbed him in the eye. With 3 powerful flaps, Sapphira brought them to a complete halt. Locking her wings outstretched, she then began to gently circle downward. "Now that was fun!" exclaimed Aragorn.
"There is no more exciting sport than flying, for if you lose, you die."
Ah, but I have complete confidence in your abilities. You would never run us into the ground. Her pleasure at his compliment radiated from her. Angling toward his tent, she shook her head, jostling him, and said,
I ought to be accustomed to it by now, but every time I come out of a dive like that, it makes my chest and wing arm so sore, the next morning I can barely move.
He patted her. Well, you shouldn't have to fly tomorrow. The wedding is our only obligation, and you can walk to it. She grunted and landed amid a billow of dust, knocking over an empty tent with her tail in the process. Dismounting, Aragorn left her grooming herself, with 6 of the elves standing nearby, and with the other 6 he trotted through the camp until he located the healer Gertrude. From her, he learned the marriage rites he would need the following day, and he practiced them with her, that he might avoid an embarrassing blunder when the moment arrived. Then Aragorn returned to his tent and washed his face and changed his clothes, before going with Sapphira to dine with King Orin and his entourage, as promised. Late that night, when the feast was finally over, Aragorn and Sapphira walked back to his tent, gazing at the stars, and talking about what had been and what yet might be. And they were happy. When they arrived at their destination, Aragorn paused and looked up at Sapphira, and his heart was so full of love he thought it might stop beating. Good night, Sapphira.
Good night, little one.
Unexpected guests. The next morning Aragorn went behind his tent, removed his heavy outer clothes, and began to glide through the poses of the second level of the Rimgar, the series of exercises the elves had invented. Soon his initial chill vanished. He began to pant from the effort, and sweat coated his limbs, which made it difficult for him to keep hold of his feet or his hands, when contorted into a position that felt as if it were going to tear the muscles from his bones. An hour later he finished the Rimgar. Drying his palms on the corner of his tent, he drew the falchion and practiced his swordsmanship for another 30 minutes. He would have preferred to continue familiarizing himself with the sword for the rest of the day, for he knew his life might depend upon his skill with it. But Roran's wedding was fast approaching, and the villagers could use all the help they could get if they were to complete the preparations in time. Refreshed, Aragorn bathed in cold water and dressed, and then he and Sapphira walked to where Elaine was overseeing the cooking of Roran and Katrina's wedding feast. Blodgarm and his companions followed a dozen or so yards behind, slipping between the tents with stealthy ease.
"Ah, good, Aragorn," Elaine said. "I had hoped you would come."
She stood with both her hands pressed into the small of her back to relieve the weight of her pregnancy, pointing with her chin past a row of spits and cauldrons suspended over a bed of coals, past a clump of men butchering a hog, past three makeshift ovens built of mud and stone, and past a pile of kegs toward a line of planks set on stumps that six women were using as a counter. She said,
"There are still 20 loaves of bread dough that have to be kneaded. Will you see to it, please?"
Then she frowned at the calluses on his knuckles.
"And try not to get those in the dough, won't you?"
The six women standing at the planks, which included Felda and Birgit, fell silent when Aragorn took his place among them. His few attempts to restart the conversation failed, but after a while, when he had given up on putting them at ease and was concentrating on his kneading, they resumed talking of their own accord. They spoke about Roran and Katrina, and how lucky the two of them were, and of the villagers' life in the camp, and of their journey thence. And then, without preamble, Felda looked over at Aragorn and said,
"Your dough looks a little sticky. Shouldn't you add some flour?"
Aragorn checked the consistency.
"You're right. Thank you."
Felda smiled, and after that the women included him in their conversation.
While Aragorn worked the warm dough, Saphira lay basking on a nearby patch of grass. The children from Carvajal played on and around her, laughing shrieks punctuated the deeper thrum of the adults' voices.
When a pair of mangy dogs started barking at Saphira, she lifted her head off the ground and growled at them. They ran away, yipping.
Everyone in the clearing was someone Aragorn had known while growing up. Horst and Fisk were on the other side of the spits, constructing tables for the feast.
Kisselt was wiping the hog's blood off his forearms. Albrecht, Balder, Mandel, and several other of the younger men were carrying poles wound with ribbons toward the hill where Roran and Katrina wished to be married. The tavern keeper, Morn, was off mixing the wedding drink with his wife Tara holding three flagons and a cask for him. A few hundred feet away, Roran was shouting something at a mule driver who was attempting to run his charges through the clearing. Loring, Delwyn, and the boy Nolfevrel stood clustered nearby, watching. With a loud curse, Roran grabbed the lead mule's harness and struggled to turn the animals round. The sight amused Aragorn. He had never known Roran to get so flustered, nor to be so short-tempered.
"The mighty warrior is nervous ere his contest," observed Isolde,
one of the six women next to Aragorn. The group laughed.
"Perhaps," Birgit said, stirring water into flour, "he is worried his sword may bend in the battle."
Gales of merriment swept the women. Aragorn's cheeks flushed. He kept his gaze fixed on the dough in front of him and increased the speed of his kneading. Bawdy jokes were common at weddings, and he had enjoyed his share before, but hearing them directed at his cousin disconcerted him. The people who would not be able to attend the wedding were as much on Aragorn's mind as those who could. He thought of Bird, Quimby, Pa, Hyder, young Elmund, Kelby, and the others who had died because of the Empire. But most of all, he thought of Garrow, and wished his uncle were still alive to see his only son acclaimed a hero by the villagers and the Varden alike, and to see him take Katrina's hand and finally become a man in full. Closing his eyes, Aragorn turned his face toward the noonday sun and smiled up at the sky, content. The weather was pleasant. The aroma of yeast, flour, roasting meat, freshly poured wine, boiling soups, sweet pastries, and melted candies suffused the clearing. His friends and family were gathered around him for celebration and not for mourning. And for the moment, he was safe, and Saphira was safe.
This is how life ought to be.
A single horn rang out across the land, unnaturally loud. Then again. And again. Everyone froze, uncertain what the three notes signified. For a brief interval the entire camp was silent except for the animals. Then the Varden's war drums began to beat. Chaos erupted.